You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Iowa caucuses are only a few days away, and the candidates are hard at work trying to woo voters. A few months ago, I spoke with Drew Weston, a psychology professor and author of a book called The Political Brain, and he says that scientific data show that successful candidates appeal to our hearts maybe even more than they do to our minds. I started out by asking him how long he's been studying political psychology.
It's a funny question. When I actually started studying, it was during the Lewinsky affair. Actually, it was the Kathleen Willey affair when I heard Pat Buchanan on television saying that what had happened to Mrs. Willey was a women's issue and a civil rights issue. And at that point, I thought, you know, when Pat Buchanan starts talking about women's issues and civil rights issues, it's time to bring the shrinks in.
So what did you come up with? You devised an experiment with partisan voters in 2004. That's way after Bill Clinton. Why did you take so long?
Well, we did some studies in between where we were trying to figure out how much reason versus emotion were actually influencing people's judgments about the whole unfolding impeachment scandal. And the answer was that reason played no effect whatsoever in the judgments of either our legislators or of everyday people, and that it boiled down to what they wanted to believe.
To some degree, others have said similar things, George Lakoff, for example. But you've tried a different approach.
Well, he's always the elephant in the room whenever I'm interviewed.
If he said something that was true, you say something that is true, or at least you'd like to believe that the two of you are saying something that is true, what's the difference?
Yes, people ask me this a lot. Probably the biggest two differences are one is I should say I have tremendous respect for George, and his book was in many respects a spur for me to write mine because I realized, oh, you can do this kind of thing, and somebody might occasionally listen. I think his fundamental ideas about framing and about not accepting Trojan horses from the other side, like support our troops, is so spot on. The biggest two differences, I think, are one is my focus is really much more on emotional resonance of the message and how much does it resonate with people emotionally. And it's also, you know, I've been a clinician for 25 years. I've worked with patients for a very long time. And in doing that, you're spending most of your time listening for what's worrying in the background of their minds that they might not be aware of, and that's the kind of thing that I focus on a lot in the book.
So how did you structure your experiment?
Well, in this study, it was right in the height of the 2004 presidential election when it was in September and August and October when partisans were pretty partisan.
And you were partisan.
I was a partisan, yes.
There's always a problem when you do a study that you may be slanting something.
Yes, and in fact, you know, the scientist in me had one set of hypotheses, and the partisan really wanted to find the Fox News circuits in the brain that lead to distortion. And unfortunately, we didn't find that. We found that both Democrats and Republicans' brains worked exactly the same way. They distorted information in exactly the same way whenever they were threatened.
So it has really nothing to do with political affiliation. That comes from other sources. For most of us, I guess, through our parents.
Yeah, most of what we feel about the parties, which is actually the biggest determinant of voting, comes from what we pick up when our parents, you know, we drive by a tough neighborhood and our parents either say, God, can you believe the way those people are acting? Or they say, we've got to do something about that. Isn't this awful? And that's where most of it comes from. There actually is another component that comes from our genes that people are starting to pull apart now.
Is that why some people actually break from their parents' parties?
That's one reason. The other is, and this is something that is tremendously important politically to know psychologically, is that both personality and partisan affiliation, feelings towards the parties, are still malleable from about 18 to 30. Once you hit about age 30, it's very rare to have a change.
So then the people who declare themselves independents are the ones who did it between 18 and 30?
Or they came from families that didn't have very strong political ideologies or particularly strong feelings about politics.
And then what about people who come to this country as immigrants and get involved in politics?
Well, if they have any sense, they vote Democrat.
I see. Well, actually, the Democrats have appealed to immigrants generally because of class issues in the past. And also, the Democrats have been good with immigrants in the past, less so today.
Less so today. Well, this is one of these areas where a different way of thinking about political messaging. How do you talk to the average person? Immigration is a great example of where Democrats could have led in a way that I think they didn't, and it wouldn't have been all that difficult to do.
So you say it's the way you talk to a voter, potential voter. Why is it a flawed approach to appeal to voters' dispassionate minds?
The biggest reason is because the parts of the brain that are involved in dispassionate, pure reason are essentially the dead zone in politics. I mean, if you actually watch partisans' brains, which is about 80% of people, there's no activity in the thinking circuits of the brain when they are confronted with information they don't like.
And it turns put electrodes on people's heads?
We actually scanned them in a brain scanner and looked at what happened as they were confronting threatening information about Kerry and Bush. And what we found was that emotion circuits lit up wildly. Circuits that are involved in regulating emotions, the I don't like this feeling, how do I get out of that circuit, circuits were lighting up. And the reasoning circuits essentially never turned on.
And I'm sure that even works when people are reading the newspaper. If there's something that is really damning about a politician they don't like, they read the complete article. If there's something about one of their favorites, they may glance at the headline.
Yeah, that's why people choose to listen to the shows they listen to. That's right.
That actually was autobiographical, so I know it's true. But what happened with Al Gore? He fell into that trap of trying to appeal to dispassionate minds during the 2000 election. But then he did the same sort of thing in the movie. And in one case, he's dismissed as a policy wonk. In the other case, he's a man who's got an important message.
Well, this is a great example of the passionate and dispassionate visions of mind at work. Al Gore in 2000 ran a dispassionate campaign. He was guided by this vision of the mind that has guided Democrats for 40 years into concession speech after concession speech, which is the idea that we're cool, rational utility calculators who are figuring out what's in my best interest and what are the right issues and what are the right policies. And that's not how the mind of the voter works. And it's one of the reasons why Al Gore never said a word about the environment in 2000. You compare that to an inconvenient truth. What was so powerful about that was the way he wedged the data. He'd given those data before, but they'd had no impact. He wedged those data into a movie with those unbelievable images of watching the glaciers fall in front of your eyes, and words he never used in the campaign, like, "This is our only home." You hear that, and you hear the intonation, and you know, in the language of the great unsung political strategist Ella Fitzgerald, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
My guest is Drew Weston. His book, "The Political Brain: The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation," is published by Public Affairs. But he talked during the 2000 debate about health care, and I can't think of a more emotional issue. What did he do wrong?
Well, I'll give you an example of what he did with Medicare. With Medicare, he was asked a question about it, and he said, well, under the governor's plan, your rates will go up between 17 and 48%. And that's according to the study by the Medicare actuaries. And I listened to that at the time and thought, you've got to be kidding.
Give me a pad and pencil.
Oh, yeah, exactly. What it betrays, though, is that vision of the mind that lies behind the Democratic strategy for the last 40 years and why we've only had one Democrat elected and reelected to the presidency. Imagine if instead he had said, you know, under his plan, your rates will go by about a third. And if you're on a fixed income, that's a lot of money. And in America, we don't treat our parents and our grandparents that way. Same content, but different feeling.
Now, you mentioned that there's only one Democrat who's been elected in quite a while, I guess, since Ronald Reagan, 1980, Bill Clinton. What makes his approach a good example of your theory? And I guess we try to think of some of the other Democrats who were popular. FDR and JFK were the two who perhaps elicited the most positive response.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Clinton, because it sounds like...
And he gave you a blurb for your book, so you must like him a lot.
Well, you should definitely read it.
It's too long, but it's nice.
No, he was very kind. He called me last weekend to tell me that he really appreciated the book. What he did was he understood that the structure of an emotional argument is different from the structure of a rational argument. The structure of what Al Gore did was a rational argument. It was, let me lay out the facts and then you decide. It's what Fox News says, but not quite the same way. What Clinton would always do is he would lead with something emotional, whether it was a story, whether it was something from his life, whether it was some values issue, some moral issue confronting the country. He'd then say, look where we are now, like in 1992. He'd say, we're in the midst of a failed economic theory here. It's called trickle-down. This is what it is. This is why it's a problem. This is what I'm going to do. And then he closes his argument with an emotional appeal that makes you feel like this guy is listening, he cares, he's going to do something about it.
Well, FDR was very patrician in style, and to some degree so was John F. Kennedy. How come they made those connections? It's different than Bill Clinton, who was a poor boy made good.
Well, things obviously have changed in a different historical eras. People respond to different things. But FDR, if you listen to those fireside chats, one of his very first ones, it may have been his first one, he was talking about, you know, the country's in the midst of a terrible depression. I mean, I remember this from my mom talking about what it was like when her mom said to her, when she said, I'm hungry, and she says, I'm sorry, sweetie, we don't have anything. And he came to the American people and he said, look, I'm not going to lie to you. We've made some progress already in just a few short months, but you know, and then he gave people some details, and some of them were over people's heads. And I think actually in that case, it didn't work like Al Gore's details over people's heads worked. It actually worked because they wanted to know he got it. And then what he concluded with was he said, you know, Teddy Roosevelt said, if I'm right about 75% of the time, I'm happy with that batting average. And he said, I hope I could be like Teddy.
How does the science of the brain support your theory?
Well, what the science of the brain is increasingly showing is that the brain is an emotional brain, and by extension, the political brain is an emotional brain. It is not a dispassionate calculator.
The amygdala plays a role in all of this?
Sure. One of the parts of the brain that was active when our partisans were confronted with threatening information. So the kind of thing we gave them was we gave them a slide. They're lying in the scanner. We give them a slide that says, say you're a partisan Democrat. It says, in 1996 on Meet the Press, John Kerry said, we must solve the Social Security problem. It means putting everything on the table. Everything's under consideration. We have a generational responsibility to solve this crisis. And yet, as a Democrat, you think, good, he's speaking honestly, I like this. Then the next slide comes up. In 2004, John Kerry said, I would never touch Social Security. We have a generational responsibility to our seniors. So if you're thinking with a rational mind, which it turns out in our study nobody was, you would expect to see activations in the parts of the brain that are involved in thinking. We didn't see those, but we saw a lot. We saw the amygdala flaring, and we saw two or three other emotion circuits that were going off saying, I am in distress. How do I get out of this?
Doesn't this worry you a little bit? I mean, this sounds like never underestimate the I don't want to say the stupidity of the American voter. I'm one of them. But if people are just ignoring basic truths, then we got real problems, don't we?
Well, the scary thing is it's actually probably more true of those of us who are more educated, because people who are more educated about politics are more partisan. And the more partisan you are, the less likely you are to listen to reason.
My guest is Drew Westen, a clinical professor. What are we going to call you, Drew? you're a psychologist.
Psychologist will do.
And a psychology professor at Emory University. His book that we are discussing is The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. It is published by Public Affairs, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Drew Westen, and we're talking about his book, The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. It's published by Public Affairs. Does taking an emotional approach to campaign raise certain ethical questions? When does appealing to emotions become pandering?
That's a question I get asked a lot, and I actually spend almost an entire chapter on, because I think what Democrats need to be doing is they need to be emulating a lot of the messaging strategies of conservatives, but not the ethics of them.
And who should be looking at the ethics? I guess the press should, but aren't we as caught up in the whole thing as everyone else?
Well, you know, if you think about what you want to accomplish with any kind of political appeal, to take something like the estate tax and turn it into the death tax, and that was brilliant because immediately what you think is, and of course it's Frank Luntz's work, immediately you think, well, that's not fair. Taxing on when you die, you paid income tax all the way along. That's the kind of language that doesn't bother me. I think that's taking something and turning it into an emotional issue. Calling a bill written by a bunch of polluters the Clear Skies Act, that's where I start having trouble.
What about people who charge that your theory implicitly supports stratification between a political elite and a dumb public that should be duped?
See, my argument is exactly the opposite, which is that if you connect emotionally with voters, what you want to do is you want to tell them what your values are. Because realistically, anybody's 15-point health care plan is not going to make it through Congress. There's 535 egos it's got to pass through before it's going to get there.
So you should talk about your values, not your policy ideas?
You should what the data suggests is, from about 40 years of elections, is that the best predictors of people's voting behavior is their feelings towards your principles and your party, and it's not the specific policies.
So Americans are looking for feel-good candidates. That worked very well for George W. Bush, but then the luster wore off as we've seen his declining popularity. And now, after being reelected, the word that people are using most is incompetent. So somewhere along the line, you have to deliver, don't you?
Yes, you do. And it worked for George W. Bush only because the Democrats never attacked him the way he attacked them. I mean, the fact that George W. Bush ran a character campaign against Al Gore and John Kerry, two men I think of pretty good character, given his history, and that they never said a word about his history, is extraordinary. And it speaks again to, if you start with the wrong premises about how the mind works, you're going to make a lot of mistakes getting elected.
So it's also about smear campaigns.
No, it's about telling the truth and not jamming people's emotional radar.
John Kerry was attacked, for example, for his war record, on his war record, which seems to have been exemplary, and he didn't respond well. This is the whole Swift vote thing. We've seen again and again Americans say, I don't want smear campaigns, and then they vote for the person who is doing the smearing.
Well, and this is why you should never listen to focus groups on these things, because most of these processes that influence voters are unconscious. And if you ask people conscious questions about unconscious processes, it's like asking someone, what do you think is happening in your pancreas right now? They can't tell you.
But you said then we should stress values. Well, isn't that what the Republican Party has done?
And they have made it sound as if values, that it's the party of values against the party of policies, and we have absolutely played into that. I mean, think about poverty. What is that? That's a values issue. What is taking
care
of the
environment? That's what John Edwards is saying.
Yes, and I think he's absolutely right to do it. If you think about what are the values on the left versus the values of the right, we should be talking about there are two parties with two competing value systems. We don't have here the party of the policy against the party of the values.
Well, what do you think is wrong with how Democrats have managed wedge issues like gun control in the past or abortion?
I think the better question is what's been right about how they've managed those. I mean, the biggest problem with the Democratic response on all those wedge issues is to back down, to say, these are radioactive, let's take them off the table. The problem is, in doing that, is that people vote with their passion, and if all the issues that have passion around them you take off the table, you're essentially handing them to the other side.
So if you assume that people who have strong feelings about abortion or about the right to own firearms are going to vote against your party anyway, why not take the strongest position possible?
Well, you could do it two ways. If you're living in New York, you take the strongest position possible, and you say, we're going to have gun regulations that are really going to take the guns off the street. You can't say that everywhere in America, and not everyone in America believes that. There are a lot of people in America who think hunters ought to have the right to hunt, and that people ought to have the right to have a gun to protect their homes.
But so I'm kind of surprised that Bill Clinton loves this, because he was the master of triangulation, exactly what you're talking against.
Well, the other thing that Bill Clinton did, though, in some very key moments was he led. I mean, gun control is a great example where the Brady bill was not above 50% when he championed it. Democrats were at 30% in the polls on welfare when he said, you know what, boys, we're taking on welfare. The assault ban.
Well, he took a Republican position on welfare.
He took a position that was a mixed one, and this is one where if I could just go back to guns for a second, he pushed through an assault ban weapon that was not at 50% in the polls. By the end of the time he'd done it, it was at 65% in the polls. As soon as Democrats get silent on things that they care about, no one has any idea what they care about. And at this point, most people don't know what a Democrat is.
Well, at the beginning of every convention, the Democrats come up with a party platform. The Republicans come up with a party platform. Is this a waste of time and energy?
It wouldn't be a waste of time if people did more what Bill Clinton did, which was to put together a values-focused party platform, which says, this is what we care about. We care about not dividing Americans on the basis of their skin color or their sexual orientation. We care about making sure that we have an economy that's strong, but also making sure that, you know, sometimes the invisible hand of capitalism turns into sticky fingers. We need to make sure that those fingers are regulated. That's the kind of thing that Democrats could talk about their values, but we typically don't.
Well, during the last election, the Democrats had many opportunities to talk about them. They barely achieved a majority in the House and Senate. In fact, Duke Cunningham's district went to a Republican.
Right. Well, you know, it's hard to remember this, but in early 2006, Democratic Party strategists were telling their candidates not to talk about the war because it was just too scary. It wasn't running high enough in the polls. As soon as you do that, I mean, think about what just happened a few weeks ago when the Democratic Congress backed down to the president, who was at 28% in the polls with an unpopular war and said, okay, we'll sign your bill. What it didn't matter what was happening as their lips were flapping. What the American people were heard was Democrats are cowards. And if you want to convince people that you're strong on national security, you better show with those meta messages that you can stand up to somebody who's a bully.
Well, do Republicans still have a monopoly on the issues of terrorism and national security?
They will continue to have one until Democrats start attacking back.
It's interesting that those issues resonate with so many voters outside of New York, especially in 2004. You have a hypothetical minor that you write about in Pennsylvania. Why didn't it resonate the same way for most New Yorkers, the city that was hit by the terrorists?
You know, I think one of the biggest reasons is that New Yorkers, although they don't always know it, are just like people in Kansas. We ask the question, you know, what's the matter with Kansas that these blue-collar workers are voting for Republicans who are cutting taxes for rich people? New Yorkers, like everyone else, are values voters. They care about things like the protection of our earth. They care about things like poverty. They care about things like that everybody's got access to a doctor for their family. And they put those things above narrowly construed self-interest.
Drew Weston is my guest, W-E-S-T-E-N. His book, The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation, is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We are also available as a podcast, and we're broadcast on satellite. I'm Leonard Lopate. What elements make up a compelling political narrative? What was it about the Swift Boat incident that made it such a strong and damaging political narrative about John Kerry when it was quite obvious that it was untrue?
Well, there are two things that did it. One was, if you listened to that, you heard testimony from people saying, I was the doctor there. This guy wasn't hurt. That was made up. You know, you hear that, and if no one says something on the other side, you believe it. And that's the flip side is that the second reason is that George Bush was running a campaign against John Kerry after 9/11 saying, this guy's going to be weak in the face of aggression. What happened? Someone attacks him with a completely untrue attack on his honor. And instead of fighting back, he backs off, he waits 3 weeks, and sends his female campaign manager to write a letter to the campaign manager of George Bush. What he did was simply to reaffirm the story that was being told about him. He's weak on aggression.
He says that it was because of decisions by other people also. He was away at the time and whatever else, a whole bunch of things happened. And perhaps it's the consultants you talked about earlier who are really at fault here. What are they doing wrong? They're looking at focus groups?
Yes. In fact, they took focus groups and asked people, you know, do you like negativity? People said no, and they believed them. And that's not how you can possibly run a campaign.
Will Rudolph Giuliani's ongoing efforts to evoke 9/11 continue to work for him, do you think?
It depends on how well the emotional appeal of the firefighters who now are saying he was not the hero of 9/11 to us works, and it depends on how much Democrats and, well, his own primary opponents start asking questions like, how can a guy with three marriages talk about family values? I guess you can say you have lots of families, you have lots of family values.
Well, people keep on changing their stories and their approaches. When is it time to refresh them? Why is John McCain's straight talk approach, which worked so well for him in the past, failing him now?
Because he let it go. I mean, what when John went, the biggest mistake John McCain ever went was to go and kiss the brass ring of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson.
You think that really, really affected a lot of Republicans?
It affected everybody in the middle, and affected a lot of those of us on the left who didn't like his positions on a lot of things, but we liked at a gut level, we liked the man. We thought, you know, this man's honest, I like him. And he lost that after he did that.
Well, actually, perhaps it revealed who he was, because there were many people, Democrats, who were confused by the calls for a ticket that would have a Democrat and John McCain together, because John McCain is a pretty conservative guy. He
yes,
doesn't
he
really have any much to do with the Democratic Party.
No, but you know, he's a great example.
It's amazing how he's so reviled by the conservatives in the Republican Party, because he's been consistently conservative.
Yes, he
it's
has.
Because of the straight talk, perhaps.
It is. Well, that's why he didn't appeal to the conservatives, because he wasn't talking straight the way they wanted him to talk. And he appealed to Democrats because they said, you know, I don't agree with him on every issue, but boy, I like this guy. I like his gut.
What about Fred Thompson? Is his appeal that he comes across as a more sincere straight talker?
Well, personally, I really like his character on Law and Order. If he runs with that character, he's going to be a tough guy to beat.
So this is, to some degree, a Ronald Reagan thing again? That we have a certain fondness for the character the candidate has played?
Well, it really helps to be an actor. And he also has the conservative bona fides, and he's got that nice little that Southern accent, which plays well in a lot of the country.
You talked about Frank Luntz before and how he came up with those slogans that were really successful. It was interesting because he was on the show, and the audience reacted very poorly to him, even though I suspect that they reacted very strongly to some of the things he had come up with in the past. Perhaps they felt that he had duped them. But what is the role of word choice in politics? What made the language of the Contract for America, for example, so successful at that time?
Well, it's because Frank is both a brilliant wordsmith and he also understands the value of science in testing out his ideas. So he didn't just shoot from the hip. He actually tested those things to see which ones worked best.
And what about music? Hillary Clinton has just started a recent song contest. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, it's a pretty dangerous thing to do unless you control the content of what shows up on as the songs that people pick.
You could just reveal the ones you want to reveal.
Yes, and that's right. That makes a lot of sense.
I'm sure that's what's going to happen.
I would think so if they have any sense. There is a great example, though, of how it does matter. And this is, again, where if you start from this vision of a dispassionate mind who's calculating things, you won't recognize the importance of having a musical score that's congruent with your message. There was a race in Colorado lost by 7,000 votes by a Democrat who ran Angie Pacioni, who ran this excellent attack ad. The text was beautiful, and in the background they were running swelling Gone with the Wind music, and it was completely undercutting exactly what she was saying. How that could get by someone making an ad, I have no idea.
Well, the winner in the Hillary contest was something by Celine Dion. Now, she's Canadian, isn't she?
I don't think we should talk about that too much.
Well, maybe Hillary will come up with a new health plan, something closer to the Canadian one as a result of this.
Or maybe she can suggest we annex Canada.
What are your principles of managing an emotional portfolio? I put that in quotes because those are your words.
Well, there's a couple of things. One of them is, if you don't feel it, don't use it. If there's anything the Democrats need to know, it is, if you don't feel, when you say the environment or you say global warming, those things mean nothing to people. Our whole language on the left needs an extreme makeover. No, it's all emotionally barren.
And you made this book openly partisan. Did you see it as setting a new strategy for Democrats?
Well, this was a tough call, you know, because I've been a scientist all my life, and I'm still a scientist. And I had a tough call on deciding what to do, but I finally decided that if I was going to write a book about passion in politics, I wanted to illustrate, using the kind of language in the book, how you would actually talk to voters, how you communicate effectively with people.
Well, it's led to the New York Times reporting that George Soros wanted to throw you a book party. Now, George Soros is one of those, his name is one of those emotionally fraught names, along with Michael Moore and a few others. If Republicans ever want to tell people that you're not to be trusted, they say, well, he's just a George Soros type or a Michael Moore type.
Yeah, they'll certainly try that. And I gather that Rush Limbaugh has already spent two segments on my book, and it just came out 2 weeks ago, which I'm quite quite happy about myself.
And he's been just finding it an awful book, or does he not see something to be something worthy in this book?
Well, what's so interesting is what he's mostly saying is, so what else is due? Emotion matters in politics. And
he knows that as well as anyone in the world.
Yes, he most certainly does. And so do Republicans in general, who would never send somebody out on television without choosing their words carefully and making sure they have emotional resonance.
Well, judging from what I've seen in this campaign, the Democrats seem to have gotten this message on the whole. I don't know whether every one of them has, but Hillary is going for emotional things a lot more. Barack Obama stirs up people's emotions. John Edwards, I don't want to leave any of the other candidates out. I'm sure Bill Richardson would if he could. Dennis Kucinich, if anybody ever reported anything he said. And I'm sure the same thing is true for the Republicans, because their advisors have been giving him that advice for a long time. So what do you think that's going to happen? Will they all just cancel each other out?
Hard to say. What we're seeing already in the Democratic primaries is a push for people like Obama to start focusing less on the values and emotion appeal and more on their 15-point plans. Personally, I think it's a tremendous mistake, because 40 years of data suggests that loses you elections.
But Paul Krugman loves that sort of thing. He says, well, we want to have a president who actually has some ideas.
I love Paul Krugman, but I doubt he's voted for someone who's won in a very long time.
Drew Weston is a psychology professor at Emory University, the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. It is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.